Thanks very much, Alois. Or Lewis, I think you were saying the other night. No, I'd just like to echo Alfred's thanks to you for inviting us out here. It's sort of quite routine whenever I do anything like this, and I have to apologise for my title. And I'm not sure that this time is any different, I'm afraid. But if it's not clear, I hope that it will become so over the next 20 minutes or thereabouts. I mean, as an archivist and not a philosopher, what I've tried to do in this piece is to give an idea of how archivists approach cataloguing an archive, obviously with special reference to the NACAS. However, I've also tried to indicate why this approach is important to the wider community of scholars in helping them to understand the material that is at the very source of their scholarly endeavour. Whether they imbibe straight from the spring or via the conduit of publications. And also to show there's a certain amount of method behind it. Or to paraphrase Edmund Blackadder, we don't just put on a funny hat and trust to luck. The catalogue of Wittgenstein's literary remains by von Wright will be familiar to all users of the NACAS, whether they've consulted the originals in Cambridge, Vienna and elsewhere, whether they've used the facsimiles and the electronic text provided by the Wittgenstein archive at the University of Bergen, or indeed whether they've used the publications of the Wiener Ausgabe. First published in 1969, as we heard earlier, the catalogue was absolutely vital at a time when the literary trustees had achieved much that they wanted to do in terms of publishing and wanted to bring together material that was divided amongst themselves and amongst their collaborators. The NACAS material held by the trustees, together with the majority of the Austrian material, I'm not actually sure that is the case, is that often about, I'm a, was, as we know, eventually deposited in Trinity College Library, hence my presence here this week. In combination with this deposit, von Wright's catalogue opened the way for a growing number of Wittgenstein scholars to make use of the NACAS, although I grant you that access was slow at first. Yet without it, scholars would have had no reference point from which to discuss its constituent parts, which they were only becoming used to using as an alternative and in addition to the posthumous publications. The catalogue has been in use ever since, the reference numbers becoming synonymous with the NACAS items themselves. So if I was now to shout TypeScript 213, I'm sure that you would shout back in unison that this signifies the big TypeScript. Out of regard for speakers in the parallel sessions, I will not attempt this experiment. But if I were to reply to your answer with the question, which one, there may at least be some hesitation. Since the publication of the catalogue, the NACAS has not remained static. As further material has emerged, the catalogue has periodically been updated to accommodate new items. For example, in Klager and Nordmann's Philosophical Occasions. Yet this process has not always kept pace with the discovery of new material, as is invariably the case with all catalogues published using traditional methods. It may also be claimed that the correct decisions have not always been made in deciding what should be included or what should be excluded from the NACAS. Nevertheless, it is clear in the modern age that maintaining the von Wright catalogue online would be a comparatively simple process, which would allow for rapid updates as new material is found. However, my main purpose here today is to argue that the catalogue as it stands is fundamentally flawed in the way that it purports to represent the reality of the NACAS and in the way it guides users through it. Indeed, I firmly believe that it is time that it was radically revised. Such a revised catalogue will provide administrative improvements in the areas of updating the record and in complying with what we might call industry standards. Beyond this, though, as an archivist acutely interested in the structure of the archives in my care, I would welcome the chance to try and convince the present audience that there are also intellectual benefits to be had. And here I want to consider the subject of Wittgenstein's process. A number of textual theories, whether the French genetic school with their study of the dossier of avant texte and text, or the Anglo-American school based on authorial intention, stress the importance of being aware of the continually developing process of the author in the production of their text. Such theories are rewarding both to scholars seeking to edit the text and those who seek to understand the text through the process of its author alike. In the case of Wittgenstein, an understanding of his process has clearly contributed to our understanding of his philosophy and to its development. And here I mean by process, not that which he enjoyed while employed, should I say, while doing philosophy, as he called it, but that by which he sought to communicate it through the written word, though there is clearly, of course, a causal connection between the two. Examples of the type of study that concentrates on this aspect of Wittgenstein's method include the work of Baker, which always shows an awareness of Wittgenstein's process, or papers such as Wittgenstein's Paperwork by Herbert Prakovets, which is intimately concerned with the way in which the philosopher worked, while the recent Kringlebook project of Joseph Rothout, where a new understanding of an aspect of Wittgenstein's process is central to the work, is also an example of its importance. Certainly in the cases of Baker and Rothout, the aspect of Wittgenstein's process that fall under the spotlight are what we might call elements of microprocess, the use of italics, for example, in the work of the former, or the marks by which Wittgenstein indicated whether or not a remark was to be used in a subsequent text in the latter. Similar elements of what we call microprocess include Wittgenstein's way of marking insertions in a text, or the way in which he wished to rearrange remarks, you know, to page 172, volume 10, or continued from page 14, and his means of indicating alternative readings with slashes. Less often considered are what by analogy we must call the elements of macroprocess, as revealed in the Nash class. Unlike microprocess, the word macroprocess does not appear to be cited in the Oxford English Dictionary. But I think that we all get the gist of what I mean. Append the prefix macro to any word, and we're talking about the big stuff. More specifically, I mean by macroprocess those elements of process that exist at document or higher level, or which substantially affect the nature of the document as a whole. For example, the choice of arrangement in extenso, for example, alphabetically. Such elements play an important part in the contextualisation both of documents and of the text that they carry, which assist us in understanding both their importance and meaning. One important aspect of macroprocess relating to the survival of Wittgenstein's later philosophy is his choice of what to preserve. Another is the interrelationship between the various documents that Wittgenstein created and the way he organised these documents when they were in use, as we saw from the diagrams that Alfred put up just a few minutes ago. A third is the purpose for which a document or series of documents were created or used, the purpose for which Wittgenstein created them. Although these elements are implicitly acknowledged, von Wright does so in the historical introduction to his catalogue, their importance is rarely explicitly discussed. Often the evidence of macroprocess is ignored in favour of that of microprocess. But both are fundamental to our understanding of how Wittgenstein worked. Let's first look on what makes up the totality of Wittgenstein's Nachlass, which was created by the philosopher in the course of his work, and which he made a deliberate effort to preserve. I'm thinking here actually of the opposite, on the flip side, of course, is bonfires in Ireland and Norway. And also the fact that he chose to deliver into the hands of a group of people he thought might make something of the material. And the fact that Wittgenstein explicitly chose to do this should not be overlooked. The Nachlass did not, for the most part, survive by accident. Unless you can count the fact that the Wren Library was fortunate not to be bombed during the war. The NACLAS as we know it originates from a fundamental single intellectual province, that of Wittgenstein himself, although despite the fact that a posthumous province of certain caches of NACLAS material might differ slightly from each other. What is important is the fact that it is the evidence of this provenance which gives the manuscripts their authority and makes them material of high evidential value. Indeed, it is only by establishing the true identity of a manuscript that the elements of microprocess recorded in it have any authority at all. Or put another way, all the detailed analysis of the elements of microprocess within a document is worth nothing if a study of the origins of the document itself proves it not to be by Wittgenstein. A second element of macroprocess I would like to bring to your attention is the way in which Wittgenstein arranged his manuscripts as he worked on them over time. And it is important here that I refer to the arrangement as made by Wittgenstein in contrast to any one imposed by later intervention. Even a brief acquaintance with the NACLAS reveals a number of series of documents that Wittgenstein created. We saw them earlier. The large notebooks, the pocket notebooks, papers for the lecture on ethics, materials for the Tractatus and the like. Although many authors acknowledge their existence, rarely do they comment on their importance. Again, it is necessary to stress that they were not created accidentally. Wittgenstein created them for a purpose as part of his process. It is thus an important part of understanding the significance of a particular document and the text that it contains to identify the criteria for inclusion of any series that it forms a part. It is clearly material, in the legal sense, I suppose, that he chose to copy a particular remark from a pocket notebook to one of the large notebooks. But the significance of this is only revealed when we understand the purpose for which he created each series. Both series run in parallel, and again, I'm repeating in a way what Alfred said. In general, the small notebooks were used for making notes as he thought of them, often on the hoof, as they were small enough in format to fit in a jacket pocket. While the larger, his volumes of record, as Brian McGuinness refers to them, tend to be used for the selection of remarks that met with Wittgenstein's approval and for the working up of material. Therefore, the identity of these series is important to our understanding of the series and of the remarks therein, and by extension, it is also important in adding to our understanding of the NACLAS as a whole. These elements of process also reveal a further most important aspect, that is the interrelationship and interdependence between macroprocess and microprocess. Archives do not, by and large, come with a rule book, which tells us how they can be used and for what purpose they can be used. Rather, we need to understand them by interrogating internal factors which allow us to build up a picture of how they were constructed and for what purpose. Such an examination is often cyclical, later discoveries forcing us to reinterpret earlier ones, which in turn inform new discoveries. As part of this process of discovery, elements of microprocess inform macroprocess and vice versa, so an understanding of both is necessary to get the fullest possible picture of what Wittgenstein was trying to achieve. And it seems to me on this front there is still much to discover. So it's clear then that I believe that the study of process is an important tool in our attempts to understand an author. But where does it leave us with our questions about the existing Fronwright catalogue of the NACLAS? I claim that the evidence of macroprocess that is internal to the NACLAS is vitally important in our understanding of the NACLAS as a whole and of the individual items within it. And therefore, it is not a trivial matter that we should take steps to preserve and document it. And here I come to the subject of my title. This is essentially what archivists not only do, but are trained to do, although I admit we don't always get it right. Although we are interested in all aspects of process for the way in which they inform us of the archives in our care, it is specifically aspects of macro process that we document by embedding our understanding of it within the catalogue. The method that we have employed to do this, traditionally, is one of creating hierarchical catalogues, which seek to represent the organic nature of the material they represent, material that is developed over time, rather than imposing a synthetic arrangement on the archive, as is what I believe has happened in the current catalogue. In this, we are guided by internal factors within the archive, rather than by external systems. Though in more positivistic times this methodology was seen as rendering the archivist's work invisible, I think we must now acknowledge that this cannot be so, though the same method takes us a long way to preserving the context of each document. Now, having said that, an examination of the NACLAS soon shows that the von Wright catalogue does not fulfil this purpose. If, for example, the high-level division of the NACLAS into manuscripts, typescripts and dictations a reflection of Wittgenstein's real process? Is the fact that multiple copies of typescripts such as the big typescript are ignored in favour of one catalogue entry, though they are edited into completely different texts? If the answer to either of these questions is no, I believe we should be looking to create a new catalogue drawn up on lines that the archival profession might recognise. Now, some could argue that von Wright's catalogue is clearly meant to be only a list of items within the NACLAS divided into sections and manuscripts, typescripts and dictations. However, whatever his intentions, because of the way we respond to text, both the verbal and the non-verbal content, I do not believe that a text can be so neutral. Instead, I believe a catalogue is a discourse between writer and reader, which has a semiotic dimension. In its layout, grouping together and splitting apart of individual items, it provides us with symbols in the Pearson sense, in that interpretation of them requires an understanding of convention. Correctly contextualised and decoded, these symbols carry meaning. Indeed, due to the formal nature of a catalogue, it might be said that not only is it likely to carry a great deal of symbolic material, but also that the reader is more likely to want to decode it, whether the outcomes are what the author intended or not. And, for example, in a literary manuscript. Indeed, the symbols in a badly constructed catalogue may be so powerful as to mislead us in our interpretation of the archive and bring about incorrect assumptions about the nature of the archive. From this standpoint, we might ask ourselves whether the von Wright catalogue is giving us signs that are either correct or consistent. Considering the catalogue in these terms leads me to another aspect of the task, that of making it computer readable. That the logical components of archival description and their relations to one another need to be accurately identified in a machine readable form. I've indicated that as human beings we take into account a number of aspects when we read a catalogue. However, without our common life experiences, a computer is not able to correctly interpret these aspects. So how do we persuade it to do so, and how do we persuade it to read the signs correctly? In the world of linguistics, this is done by using a markup language, such as XML, aided by supporting ontology. This methodology is actually very similar to that employed in creating the machine-readable texts that make up the basis of the Bergen electronic edition. Now, for archivists, an off-the-peg solution already exists, in the form of encoded archival description, or EAD for short. Based on international standards, EAD has rapidly become an international standard in its own right, that for the markup of archival catalogues, with a view to making them computer readable. Because of its rapid acceptance and the fact that it is based on XML, it offers a number of advantages over systems developed in-house. First, because it is community-led and contains no proprietorial encoding, any files created in EAD should be pretty much future-proof. Secondly, the standards that the use of EAD encourages make the virtual reintegration of archives that have been dispersed possible. This element is, of course, central to a discussion of the NACLAS. Thirdly, EAD encourages interoperability with other EAD and XML-based projects. So a Wittgenstein catalogue produced in EAD might also be used to supply data to a catalogue of all philosophers' papers, or the data from it might be used in some way with the data from Bergen Electronic Editions XML files. So then the challenge of producing what I hope would be a more successful catalogue of the NACLAS is, I think, threefold. First, we have to produce a catalogue using the most up-to-date standards, which will allow easy linking with a web-based Bergen Electronic Edition and other similar projects. Secondly, we need to preserve all evidence of process that we can, not only because of what it adds to our knowledge of the NACLAS as a whole and the individual items within it, but also because the evidential authority of NACLAS items depends on it. Finally, we need to ensure that the catalogue is easily interpreted, that the signs can be easily read. It's perhaps too late for my generation to benefit greatly from a catalogue drawn upon organic lines. The words of von Wright are probably burnt too deep in our minds. However, I can see great benefits for younger scholars in producing something which allows us to navigate the NACLAS in a more informed way. Wittgenstein used a simile that compared his philosophical investigations with a man traversing a landscape. Perhaps we should look on an ideal catalogue of the NACLAS as a small-scale map, not of a town or a city, but of a whole country, which points us in the right general direction to proceed and places our journey in the context of the land around us. I'll stop there.